This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
So we have a period of time for our panel, and I'm going to go back to Paul first to reflect a bit from your long list of things that you had this morning on how many of them we might have touched upon and where you feel in terms of your role in the council and this new kind of vista that you're looking at, that you see working with the different organisations and partnerships that might be available for to start you off.
I think the nub of a lot of things is about assessment and the process is whatever we describe as S139A, because to a certain extent that is the baton passing, whether it's passed or not, and some you refer to it not being passed in some cases, and that's a tragedy as much as the complexity of the form itself. So I think process is one of those things which doesn't really excite people, but we've got to get right, and whatever it is and whatever it becomes, it has to be better than it currently is, and it has to be owned as part of the transition process. The other thing is the dialogue between the providers themselves, and I think that's really key. As a local authority, I don't necessarily want to sit in as a mediator between different providers. I want to encourage them to meet and discuss and then come and have a discussion with me or with whoever as to what the outcome of those discussions are. Facilitation, it should be not about about sort of developing things yourself as a local authority. It's about listening to what the process is. And so what I've got out of this to a certain extent is in Doncaster and South Yorkshire is to ensure that the networks and the processes we've got are as open as possible so that everybody feels that they can come and attend, but we can actually ensure that we mediate between people and to make sure that there's common ground and common understanding of what is required. So I think this has been really helpful because it's put the cases very profoundly from different people's points of view, but then we've got to take that and build the conversations around it which actually will deal with actions. And none of that, I think, actually is affected by the funding crisis or funding issues. What it is about making best use of what we've got, and the conversation is the important starting point, and the way it's the money spent is the end point, really.
Thank you, Paul. And we mustn't forget some students will go on to higher education. So those aspects of progression of what you're commissioning and what you're providing at colleges is it, the average age of the disabled student in higher education is 25. That's partly because it takes them so long to get there, partly because they have to acquire the qualifications to get there, but also, as Alison said, you have to learn to negotiate your own support. If you're given a direct payment or a disabled student's allowance and you use it to employ a support worker, you need support in employment. Lots of universities do that for students, and so do centres of independent living. So there is a progression route here. Well, as we're looking at progression, it isn't all vocational and it isn't all educational. It is a progression route where you're actually managing your life as an adult and how it's going to be and using those support programmes that are available.
I just wanted to quickly to say that when you go into employment, there was a very good piece of work done, again, a long time ago called the Employability Package, and it's since been reiterated in various guises as employability skills. But we do know that for many of our learners, it's not the task that they have to do when they get to work that is the challenge. They can learn to do that, but it's getting there. It's knowing how to speak to colleagues. It's knowing how to speak to the boss. It's just knowing, if you've got a little rest space, there are all sorts of hidden things going on there, all those unwritten rules, all the body language that goes on. And understanding that, those are the things that really matter and that keep people in work as opposed to them losing work. And I think that broad curriculum that supports that is absolutely crucial.
And I think that also leads us on to social firms and the opportunities they offer. I don't want to pick on our colleague from City of Bristol, but you were running a social firm at City of Bristol College. Are you aware of it? A social firm, an actual supported employment where the money was ploughed back into the work. I'm sorry, I need to send the lady with the microphone.
Yeah, I mean, we've got young enterprise groups that we were running that were, mm-hmm. were doing that, yes. As part of our foundation education department.
Yeah, and some young enterprise groups, like at Lewisham College, I don't know if there's anyone here from Lewisham, also turned into a social firm. Posiganza, a very long established young enterprise programme, which is now a fully fledged, I think, social firm.
Linda Samways, Lewisham College. Yes, Posiganza is indeed now, it's almost like a business in that sense now. We've gone from having it as a enterprise to something much bigger. And we're running other social enterprises as well in the college now. We make our own soaps, for example,
really?
and hand lotions and bath oil. So that's another area that we're moving into, and, of course, incredibly valuable.
Can you just tell people a little bit about what Posiganza does? I've been to see it, I'm very lucky.
Yeah, Posiganza is, as it sort of suggests, is all about flowers, but it's not about. But it's about making decisions about what to purchase, going ahead to the markets and purchasing, seeking people as customers, and preparing flower arrangements, etc. Because it goes into, it's not just bouquets and posies, it's all sorts of other things. And preparing those to the customer's needs. So, and running the business in terms of keeping the books and making sure the money's coming in and going out properly.
Exactly. Thank you very much. So I'm going to throw the panel to the floor. Gentlemen here at the front. The panel's looking calm. It's okay.
Mike Clark, Wessex Youth Offending Team. Covering Hampshire, Portsmouth, Southampton and the Isle of Wight, so a very big yacht. I'm currently developing some work with a couple of our colleges around the foundation learning sort of strand and work skills specifically for young offenders in the community. One of my concerns, and it's been ongoing for a few years, is what happens to young people while they're in custody.
Yes.
Their qualifications frameworks don't match up with what's happening when they're in school or in mainstream education. And, you know, trying to get hold of those education files when a youngster comes out of custody as well is also very, very difficult. We've tried all sorts of different things to make sure that when a youngster comes out, their education files follow them out to me or one of my team. I don't know if it's a question, I guess it's just thoughts, really.
I think one of the things that we did manage to do with local authorities was to get into the ASCL Act that if a 139A assessment's being carried out, it starts while you're in the young offender institution. So the local authority doesn't just sort of vaguely pick you up when they hear about you, that actually it starts before the young offender and young person moves out again. But, Paul, is this an area for you?
I've only had marginal, and it's a bit difficult. You jump in there and you probably never get out of the system, is there? The one thing about youth offending is, I think, it's the... There's a whole range of difficulties, one of which is the different ages applied to youth offending than in other educational terms, and it can be great big holes, particularly with the connection service, I think, because who is responsible for the maintenance of the data and the information, and data sharing protocols and all the other bits and pieces. Yes. All I can say is I think that's the key thing. Is to make sure that the work, it goes back to the slide of not forgetting the past, and with that as an individual, mm-hmm. that I think it's really important that we work out where the records are and how accessible they are, mm-hmm. and that actually making that sure that's as up-to-date as possible. And you're probably carrying on in terms of asking the same question, not getting an answer, but that hopefully, if somebody actually has a record of the individuals and what they've done, then that actually is a better starting point than losing it or forgetting it.
Okay, can I
sorry.
Just...
He's
sorry.
Going to come back. Oh, yeah. It's coming. It's okay. It's on its way.
I mean, just following up that, one of the things we've done recently, and I received an email earlier on today, is we're developing some work about passing information in and out around school-age young yeah. people. I mean, I work predominantly post-16, but mm-hmm. the school-age thing's quite important. And the case study that I've been sent today is one where a Year 11 youngster was sent into prison before his GCSEs, but we got the information from the school and the exam board, and the exam board sent the exams to the secure unit, so he's sat his GCSEs. Mm-hmm. So, and this is just a piece of work that we're starting to develop yeah. and starting to kind of see we're a big yacht, so we've got to start small, but there's hope that if the YJB take interest in it, it's something we can roll out further.
Yes, and it is covered by the YPLA and the SFA within the legal framework, so there isn't any reason for them not to be interested. It's about how you, as you say, generate action out of that requirement to be interested in a complex field. It is a complex field. And young people get moved around as well, and it's even worse for adults in the prison population, I would say.
I mean, I just one of the concerns that I have, that there are young people subject to a learning difficulty assessment who are in such institutions. Goodness me, what sort of society are we when that's the case? But having said that, we know the very high proportion of disabled young people, people with dyslexia, dyscalculia, all of those specific learning difficulties and disabilities who are in the system. And we know how important learning support is to underpin and to support them in what they're trying to achieve. And, of course, there isn't that opportunity in that system to provide many aspects of the support that that would be available to those young people outside of the system. And the funding just does not allow that. The system doesn't allow that. So I think, you know, the real anxiety is that through that time, it's really difficult for people who are providing education in that system to make all of those opportunities available.
Lady over here, and then lady at the next table. We'll start with a colleague here. Thank you.
I was going to say, I was led to believe... Oh, sorry.
Tell us who you are and where you come from, sorry.
I'm Louisa, and I'm head of Post-16 at Penn. I was led to believe the Foundation Learning Tier allowed a student to get a unique learner number. So in answer to your question, you get a UNL number. And I believe the colleges are adapting that as well. So that for all the credit system, you bank it. And so it stops that revolving door, so you don't do the same accreditation twice.
Thank you. I am not an expert on unique numbers, but I know they're very important to people who worked in the Learning and Skills Council. So I don't know if there's anyone here who wants to comment. Well, perhaps colleges actually know better. But my understanding is it's meant to be portable.
Yeah.
The colleague there, I will come back to the lady at this table. So.
Well, from some of our understanding, first of all, we're not allowed to say Foundation Learning Tier anymore.
No, I know.
There's an agreement.
This was a public relations decision.
That the number will go with someone and should travel with them, but it may not and shouldn't prevent some of our learners accessing similar courses in a lateral way, as I think was raised earlier, because some of our learners will need to report and replicate and generalise learning. It should allow some people from some groups to repeat some courses where there is a need, but the idea isn't that there should be the revolving door is true, but it doesn't always apply to our type of learners. So I think there will be some. There will be some allowances for that.
Yeah. There is an understanding that because you may have studied certain things at school at a certain age, you may need to revisit these things as an adult. Is that fair, Alison?
Yes, I think so. It's about generalising, transferring, new context learning, maintenance learning, all of those things that come with the territory of people with more complex learning difficulties and disabilities, and that's been taken account of now.
There's a lady at this table who had a question, and then I'll come to you. Yes?
Hello, Carol Stacey from Hertford Regional College. My question is that whilst I appreciate the sort of the economic climate and the difficulties there are in getting people and progressing people into work, some areas of the country have a disproportionate access, if you like, to social firms and opportunities. And I also understand, given the context of the discussions we've had earlier, that obviously work can involve a whole range of meaningful activities. Under the Learning and Skills Council guidance, and I understand that that's now sort of the funding agencies have changed, but there was a statement made that any courses that had work in the title or had work as an aspiration that did not actually lead people to work would cease to be funded. And I just wondered where that statement had gone to in the transition from the funding agencies into the YPLA.
There was an issue about people sitting in the classroom and learning about work, I think. But I think the foundation learning has taken over from that. So
has that gone now?
Well, the foundation learning is a suite of qualifications around which you can build a learner programme. So it has overtaken it, I think that's fair to say. Yes. I know that Alison has to go, but there is another question.
I hope it's in one of those boxes that they stashed a whole load of stuff in the middle of March and that hasn't seen the light of day again.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Stephen King, Deputy Head from St Nicholas Special School in Canterbury. I've come along to have a look at what's going on when people leave our school and then go into the life beyond. In Kent, they launched a set of transition protocols, which was quite, you know, flag-reaching as far as national approaches to transition planning, but they are implemented in some places better than others, etc., etc. One of my concerns is that if a young person comes to our school, we implement person-centred reviews from year nine upwards every year, as opposed to annual reviews of statements, so it's more than just education. When somebody leaves our school and goes on to college at 16 or 19, if they choose to leave early, the statement ceases.
Yes.
And it's a similar situation for those young students who've come from mainstream schools or from BESD schools, etc., who are vulnerable, and while they have a statement, somebody is looking out for them. My concern is what will happen and what should happen to somebody's person-centred plan when they leave the schooling situation, their statement dies. Who takes ownership of the support for that child, that young person, and the family? Because obviously everybody needs to be supported. At the moment, we're leading that because obviously we're meant to be pretty good at it. But what about other people?
Well, that person-centred plan, apart from belonging to the young person, to start off with, should travel with them to the next provider, and that should be assisted, supported by connections and the 14 to 19 team. Is that your feeling?
You hit the nail on certain heads then. I'm not sure you know how many nails you've hit. The 139A is a statutory duty for a local authority to follow that young person up until the age of 25. We've got to work out what those words, or whatever words are written in the Act, actually mean. And there is a big difference in terms of, therefore, what the entitlement is. There is a, when it first came out, and first of the discussions were, it depended on who the local authority would naturally assume should be entitled to 139A. And that goes, the difference between the 2% in our case of statementing and the 20% of School Action Plus. And it's somewhere in between the 2 and the 20. And the thing is, the data, going back to the data, actually, of who that isn't there, because there isn't clarity, particularly, can I say, in the mainstream sector, not necessarily your sector. And it's, the trouble is with the data in this sense, it's a bit like a shopping trolley that somebody else has put all the things in and you've walked off with. It's not got the materials you thought you need or you want. It might even have some that might help Alison's in terms of that qualification, but it might not be ready for you because it's been collected for different purposes. And what we need to do with data in that sense is get something which tells us who the vulnerable young people are without saying that these vulnerable young people are School Action Plus. There is enough information out there to do that. But once we've made that decision, and once that process is, the local authority is under duty bound to track and follow those people. And then it comes on to how does that actually happen? Because who pays the connection service? Because you could have four times, five times, whatever the number of young people being tracked. So, all I've done is outline the problem, and I'm sorry that I can't tell you the solution.
But thank you for raising it. I know that Alison, are you okay for a minute?
Well, I just had one quick comment, and then I do have to go. Going back to that requirement that the local authority should undertake that, particularly in relation to those young people who have statements, there's no question about that, is there? There should be that learning difficulty assessment. But I've also picked up recently that if young people leave at 19 maybe and go straight into work or part-time work or go into a social services type provision, they're not necessarily getting that learning difficulty assessment, which I think they should have, because it's still their passport back into learning at a later stage. So I think that's another thing to keep watching brief on, really. It's the entitlement of every young person, and it is their way back into learning even if that may not be the route they want to go down immediately on leaving school. So I think there are a lot of endless issues. We could spend the whole day talking about the S139A, really sadly, couldn't we?
Thank you very much, Alison. And I know that you have to go, so if we could just thank Alison for her contribution. I will take your question in a moment. I will take your question, and then we'll move on, because we have another speaker, Brian, who's going to raise some more issues that you're going to find really interesting. So do carry on.
Right. I'm a teacher at a special school, for all-age special schools, so it goes up to 19. And most of the students in our school do stay on until the 19. And we have input as a school with the transition plan into personal-centred planning, and each of the students have their personal-centred plan when they leave. And the paperwork goes on. I've got to say, I mean, we've worked with these children. We've got an intimate knowledge of them as people. And they leave. We've had our input, but then we never hear again how they're getting on. And sometimes, when they've left, problems arise. Yes. And if we could have had input later, some sort of really quite sad situations could have been avoided. Right. You know, and also I think, because they're adults, and I don't know what people feel about this, but the big question about choice, you know, I'm thinking of a young man, very complex, very autistic, who left school 12 months ago, had a plan put together, but at some point said, I don't want this, as he was wont to do. And he actually, they said, oh, well, he's an adult, he's made that choice. Now, as far as I know, that young man is at home all day because he's chosen not to have. And we just felt there was a lot of input we could have had to how Martin makes his choices.
Yes.
And I do think that is an issue for a lot of people with who have got severe learning difficulties.
Thank you for that input, because I think this is exactly what Alison is saying about how you continue to share that information, but you still allow people to have adult status and to make those decisions. But I think actually that probably leads in extremely well to what you're going to say, Brian.